Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to the panel on this Wednesday, the 1st of October. It is our shutdown edition of the roundtable panel, and we are more than a little excited because we are working and most federal workers are not. We are not rubbing it into them. We wish, I think they probably wish they were working, but that is not to be. So we'll talk about the shutdown. We'll talk about other things that have been going on over the last 24 hours. It's been a lot. A lot going on. So we'll talk about all of that. We have a great group this morning. I am thrilled to introduce them all to you and to have you with us. Panel at WAMC.org. If you would like to get in on the fun, panel at WAMC.org. And we'll get the party started now. Roger Berkowitz is here, founder and academic director of the Hannah Arendt Center for Politics and Humanities and professor of politics, philosophy, and human rights at Bard College. Good morning, Roger. How are you?
I'm great, Joe. Good to be here.
Wonderful. Roger's actually going to stay some extra innings and tell us about their big conference coming up on the 16th and 17th of October. So we will have them. We'll have Roger back with us in our 11 o'clock hour. Bo Breslin is here, Joseph Palamountain, Jr. Chair in Government at Skidmore College. Good morning, Bo. How are you?
Oh, great, Joe. Happy to be here, too.
Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin joins us. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Joe. Just a recognition that it's Yom Kippur and thinking about folks that are in thoughtful atonement right now, and it's something that maybe all of us should take a minute to think about what we can all do to make our society better. And then on a special shout out to my guy Chunk, who won the Fat Bear Week award this year, and all of those that booty shamed Chunk, he still won. So Chunk is the champion.
Despite a broken jaw and a gnarly tooth, he powered through.
He absolutely did.
Okay, I don't know what happened.
I don't
know what the hell you're talking about.
You're missing out.
I had no idea.
It's a big deal.
So this is one of the fun things that come out of our national parks, that they set up trail cams to watch the bears feed, and they decided to take pictures of the bears as they get fatter, and then they do a competition of who wins the Fat Bear Award. I raise it for two reasons. One is because Chunk overcame a lot of issues in order to be a champion.
He's an underdog.
But it's also how important our national parks are and the people who work in them.
Yeah. Now, the sad thing is that Chunk can't be a general.
No.
Disqualified.
No.
Because he'd have to shave and lose like 50 pounds.
We're going to go back to that one.
Sad. Okay, well, thank you for bringing me up to date on that. I don't know how that fell off my radar. Damn it. Nick Rangel is here, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. Good morning, Nick. How are you?
Good morning. I am great. I want to just congratulate the United Tenants of Albany on a fantastic award and anniversary celebration last night. And LASNY received the Community Partner Award, which we're very excited and proud of. So really nice event.
Great work. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Wonderful to all folks involved. Thank you very much. All right, let's get started and talk about the news of the day. As I mentioned, there's quite a lot going on in our world, whether we want it to or not. So let's talk about a government shutdown. We have one. It is underway right now. The government shut down overnight. And this is because the two sides, both the Republicans and Democrats, could not agree. And so we'll talk about that. Democrats largely voted against the Republican measure, setting up the first shutdown since President Donald Trump's first term. The federal government was set to shut down 12:01 Wednesday, which it did after Senate Democrats rejected a bill that would have extended the deadline and kept agencies open through November 21st. The upper chamber voted 55-45 on the Republican-led proposal Tuesday night, which needed 60 votes to pass. Only two Democrats, Senators John Fetterman of Pennsylvania and Catherine Cortez Masto of Nevada, voted with the GOP for the measure, along with Angus King. Just one Republican, Senator Rand Paul, joined with the Democrats in opposing it. Lawmakers had already voted down a Democratic alternative that was widely expected to fail. The two parties remain far apart from a potential deal to fund the government, and it's unclear how long this shutdown may last. Democrats say they cannot support the GOP funding extension until Republicans agree to concessions on health care policy. Republicans have said they are willing to negotiate on Democrats' chief demand, an extension of Affordable Care Act subsidies put in place during the coronavirus pandemic that will otherwise expire at the end of the year, but not until the government is open again. All right. This affects all of you, but let me go into the government guy. Professor of government.
Okay, I'll take a stab at this.
A professor of government shutdown.
Right. Right. So I'll take a stab at this, Joe. You know, usually I come to the roundtable with more confidence about how to slice these conversations. This one is complicated in a way that my confidence level is a little bit lower. But let me take a stab at thinking about the shutdown from the perspective of what makes this one different than what's been in the past. And I'll as a political scientist, I'm going to spend a little time thinking about party politics and so on. Republicans, I think, are playing this game, despite the fact that I wish they wouldn't. I think they're playing this game fairly successfully. And what I mean by that is this stalemate advantages, I think, Republicans, despite the fact that polls show that most people, or most people will blame the Republicans. But let me tell you why I think Republicans are playing this game more successfully than Democrats. They can be the savior on any government shutdown. Trump, in particular, can be the savior on any government shutdown, at the same time that he can be the employment executioner. So either way, he's going to come, the Republicans and Trump are going to come away with a victory. Either they open up government again and they save it, or Russ Vogt's going to get his way and we're going to have mass layoffs. Also, can we say that the Republicans will take a political hit? I don't think so, in part because of the fact that Trump's approval rating has stayed steady even with the threat back in the day of the shutdown. What is happening in terms of intimidation and threatening the jobs, federal jobs, is basically what the Republicans and Trump are doing anyway. So in some ways, this is a continuation of their policies with a big umbrella of shutdown over it. So I don't think this is a massive difference from what the Trump administration wants to do in the first place. And what's different than 2018, Democrats have turned more to the left and Republicans have turned more to the right since we had our 34-day shutdown in 2018. So Democrats have to pay attention to their fringe left or their more extreme left in a way that they didn't have to before, because the more moderate Democrats that were in positions of power in 2018 are no longer there. And so I think Democrats are in a tough spot. I'll say one more thing and then I'll pass it on to my fellow panelists. One of the things that makes this different is that shutdowns in the past have always included negotiation across the aisle. The Biden administration negotiated in good faith when there were potential shutdowns when Biden was president. And the Fiscal Responsibility Act of 2023 was one of those concessions that they made, right? The Republicans got, in that moment, expansion of work requirements for some SNAP recipients. That was how shutdowns ended in the past. I do not think this one's going to end in the same way, because Trump and the Republicans are so much on the ascendancy that they don't need to negotiate in the same way that Biden did a couple of years ago. I'll stop there.
All right, Nick.
I mean, I think I largely agree that the minority conferences, the Democratic Party has less motivation to move to a middle position because they do not have as many moderate purple members in their conferences right now. I also think that there's you know, some consideration of the change, the way the majorities have performed and acted since March that have undercut their reliability or the ability of the Democrats to trust that a negotiation is in good faith, right? And I think what we're hearing and what I think is going to be really difficult to describe to the public is that a budget bill can authorize an agency to spend money, but it can't force an agency to spend that money. And now that we're seeing this administration actively prevent agencies from spending money that was appropriated through a congressional budget process, there's less trust that an appropriation bill is going to effectuate the kinds of activities that that Congress intends for it to effectuate. So there is less of an incentive to pass a bill because there is not really a lot of faith that the bill will do what it is intended to do in the first place. I think there's been a tremendous amount of posturing by the Republican Party, and I think they're largely better at communicating their position and controlling the narrative among the public. And the nuances of a continuing resolution are really complicated for the public to understand. So I do think the Democrats are – this is the best shot they have at making at really leveraging any amount of power that they kind of have right now. But I think they're going to have a really, really hard time communicating how and why it advances the Democratic Party and the addresses some of the top priorities of the voting public.
Bob.
Yeah, absurd. Interesting perspectives. I'm not sure we know what's going to happen. My gut is going to be that this isn't going to be short. I think the continued losers are going to be the reputation of the political leadership on both sides of the aisle. I think there's a misread of the tenor and what's happening in the neighborhoods of this country right now. I don't think people are going to pay that much attention to the closure. I think there's much more concern about the overall economy, and this is certainly not going to help the economic conditions of the country. I think there's enough fear and concern in our communities that the uncertainty that I sense and hear wherever I am, whether it's in the supermarkets or talking to people on campus or just watching the news, I think the politicians are misreading where the people are, and the answer to that is that we get rid of the politicians. I think this could, and I kind of hope it does, lead to an absolute bloodbath at the midterm elections, because I think unless we start to flush some of these folks out of D.C., we're not going to see any changes. The messaging is, and this is sort of in a perverse way benefiting the Democratic Party, is that Trump can't help himself. And if he could keep the focus on the closure, I think the comments that Nick and Bo made are probably correct. I think he's so unhinged and unbalanced right now that he will continue to take the wind out of the sails of the closure to the point where his absurdities are going to to make the closure look passive in comparison to it. And I think we can at some point, if we point to the Dumb and Dumber DC version yesterday that we saw with Hezgeth and Trump on stage in front of the generals, is a great example of that. I mean, so there's so many other things that are pulling away from this where in the past closures it was the absolute focus. I was actually surprised when I was listening to the news both last night and tonight across a couple of different stations. They're talking about it, but there's so many other things that it's pulling away from it to the point where people don't know what to focus on. So let's get into it. Let's come back, though, to a couple things, Joe. One is I think we have to have a conversation about how this country is undervaluing its workers and what that means. And we also need to have a conversation about public service and what that means. But I'll stop and let Roger jump.
Well, thanks. I think the first thing to say, and I agree with a lot of what's been said here, especially about the radicalization of what's going on, is that I don't think this is about healthcare. I think this is a smokescreen. Healthcare is a symbol. It's a popular hook. The parties are fighting over a continuing resolution, right? They pick issues like healthcare or border security that people care about, and they latch on to them. Actually, 2% of the American people say healthcare is the number one issue. But what most people think is the number one issue is cost of living. And healthcare is one of the large inputs into cost of living. One could think of housing as a particular issue, except the Democrats or the Republicans neither have a plan for housing, so you don't make that your popular hook. And there is something that can be done about healthcare. There's probably a bipartisan solution to it, but I don't think they want to solve it right now because both parties have bigger fish to fry. The deeper issue is that there's a revolution and a counter-revolution going on in this country, and I'm increasingly of the opinion that I think some of my panelists agree with, that this is going to be long, and it could be ugly, and it could end up being more violent than we currently think. The Republicans, after decades of feeling locked out of elite institutions, be they colleges and law firms and courts and universities and also the courts. Yeah, I've said that. They moved from wanting to reform the system to be willing to completely break it. And I think Donald Trump has become – he's a wannabe tyrant. I don't think you can put it any other way. But a tyrant in the sense that he depends upon the corruption of the people. He wants power. But he doesn't have a strong sense of where this is going. I don't think he has a dream. I don't think he has a plan. But he wants to break the system, and he wants to take advantage of breaking that system. And as he does so, the Democrats, having defended the system for 40 or 50 years and in the last few years, have finally decided that it's not worth defending anymore. I don't think they have a plan either. I think there's competing, and that's why the Democrats are even more unpopular than Trump. They're down at 30% popularity. They don't agree what a new world would look like. They don't really have an idea. But Trump wants to break the system, and he's intent on doing it. And the Democrats have now realized that Trump wants to break the system. And instead of defending the system, they're willing to break the system to show that they're willing to fight. They're hoping that something will come up. I think increasingly what you see is that both sides now see the system itself as expendable. And what you're seeing then is that they stare across the table and they may just break the system. What that will mean is wildly unpredictable. But I think we're in for some new and unprecedented times right now.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. I just want to remind you that Roger will be with us in our 11 o'clock hour, as I mentioned, to talk about a festival called Joy.
Yeah, I can see the irony there.
Yeah.
Well, it's called Joy, Loving the World in Dark Times.
So, Roger's the Dark Times
part. I want to see the turn that this takes over the next 2 hours. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our program this morning. Roger Berkowitz, Bo Breslin, Bob Griffin, and Nick Rangel making up our fantastic panel this morning. We welcome your letters as always. We'll get to those letters in a little bit. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. Struck by what you were saying, Roger, as far as, you know, of how long this is going to be. And it does seem, especially with what the president has said he's going to do with firings and gutting and it seems like it's all going to be exacerbated even more, and you wonder, okay, so you got to come out of the shutdown, but then you also have to come out of what's being done as a result of the shutdown, right? I mean, that's almost two steps.
Never let a good crisis go to waste, right, Joe?
Right.
I mean, you know, I think what you just said, well, we're going to come out of the shutdown, is, I think, how most of us probably are conditioned to think this. Will we?
Right.
You know, you have two, you know, the Democrats have been so pathetic for the last years and certainly now that 30% of the country supports them at a time in which 58% of the country don't support the president. It's hard to imagine how pathetic you have to be to have those kind of numbers. They see the need to radicalize just like the Republican Party radicalized. I don't know, you know, whichever side breaks first is going to lose, right? Badly. So, yeah, I mean, when will we come out? I mean, it could be that, you know, we don't just furlough these workers and they get rehired in a couple weeks. It could be that 200,000 or 300,000 or 400,000 federal workers are fired. What that means, you know, I don't know. I'm not smart enough or knowledgeable enough to know what that will mean.
Depraved
enough. But there are other ways to think about this. The states can start to hire some of them, and they could expand their regulatory systems. They could expand their ways of doing it, and you could return to a much stronger idea of federalism. I don't know if that's going to happen or not. The problem is, of course, that the states have, for years, cut taxes in order to, for popular reasons, and depended upon the federal government to fund most of what they do. And if that were to happen, states who wanted to actually live in a more regulated, civilized world would have to raise their taxes. And you'll see real differences, even more real differences, emerge amongst blue and red states in the country than we're used to.
You go.
Well, okay. I want to go to you. But you know, what Roger was just saying about the Democrats. Monday afternoon, the Democratic leaders, Republican leaders go and they meet with the president. The Democratic leaders come out. They have the press conference in the driveway. And then the Republicans have their press conference in the driveway. If I have no political affiliation whatsoever, and I watch those two separate events, Republicans win.
For sure.
I mean, they got it. They've got the message.
Right.
They're saying the same thing. They're all on the same page. I don't know what. It just seemed as if the Democrats just seemed completely befuddled by something that, like, you know, read the paper. This has been going on for how many years? You know, it's not like it's a shock, right? It seems like you'd be ready for it.
Yeah, it's true. And I've said on the show many times that the Democrats have been embarrassingly unprepared in this moment. So now, Roger had a ton of very erudite things to say. I'm going to just pick two of them. One of the great ironies of the moment is that Democrats are, and you said it, Roger, and Bob, you said it too, relying on states, federalism, as the savior for a ship gone a wreck, right? That's American politics flipped on its head. If Democrats are relying on the state to be the savior of the republic, right? At the end of the day, Democrats in the FDR and LBJ mold have long relied on Washington as the place to save. And now we're sitting there saying, and I think you're right, Roger, somehow the states are going to save us. Secondly, I would say that there's always the constraint because states have to balance their budget. So the idea that you can bring people on board in the states is going to be super complicated because unlike the federal government, you do have to balance your budget at the state level. And then the third thing I'll say in the difference that I have with what Roger is saying, I do think, Joe, that the Republicans have a plan. I think their plan is to make America great again as a temporal thing, like go back to a time when we had paternalistic Christian nationalism, cultural, the old sort of cultural leave it to beaver mentality. And I think Democrats are not prepared for what is a sort of racist, sexist, discriminatory message that Republicans are giving on the cultural side. It used to be that Republicans would just want to make government smaller. That was their main thing. Nowadays, it's we're going to destroy all the institutions of American government and all the cultural institutions in a way that brings us back to a time in which men were in charge and white men in particular. That to me is last thing I'll say, Joe, that to me is their recipe, and Democrats have to be prepared to respond.
Go ahead, Nick, and I'll jump in.
I want to bring it back to some of the technical aspects of a shutdown, because it is true that these hypothetical fallouts are sort of on the horizon and becoming more and more likely. But in the current moment, there is not a crisis aside from knowing or the unknowable of what the party's plans are. So if an agency's already been funded, most of their work will continue to be funded. We already know that DOGE attempted to lay off thousands of federal government workers, but there are statutory mandates that require positions to exist in order to complete the work that they are obligated to complete under the law. So they were forced to rehire people to effectuate the statutes that are in place. This Congress has not passed legislation. They have not changed the laws around their obligations to do the work of these agencies. In fact, they haven't really passed very many laws at all. And so as much as a shutdown will allow this administration to lay off people it thinks are not mandatory, there's also legislation that requires furloughed employees to be paid back pay to the to their full paycheck, right? So people will be furloughed, they will get paid. People will be laid off. There are still laws that have to be completed. Many of those positions will be refilled because the courts will make them be refilled because they have an obligation to do the job of the federal government. For nonprofit organizations, there are consequences of delays in being paid, but as a nonprofit manager, we've already been awarded the next 3 months of our funding. We will continue to do our work, and we will continue to be able to be we will continue to get paid for the work we're doing for 3 months. The longest shutdown was under the previous Trump administration. It was 35 days. So that clock is ticking, but it isn't an overnight crisis. There is some space here. What I do think is interesting is the unlikelihood of this Congress getting a bill that can pass if the Democrats are willing to push that timeline out. We've been living on a continuing resolution since last year. This administration has been unable to do its work. And that what to me, I think, is the point. I think they know that they can't do the work, but they also don't want to do the work because, as Roger mentioned, the whole point is to break the system, and it's not the Democrats breaking it.
So I know that Bob wants to say a few words. I want to give him time to do that and have everyone else respond. We have to take a quick break. We're going to go over to Lockbox Central and check in over there. And when we come back, we'll continue. We'll also, of course, in a little bit, talk about the meeting that took place with the generals and military leaders yesterday. We can't let that one go without talking about it. We will return right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Great group this morning, Bo Breslin, Bob Griffin, Roger Berkowitz, and Nick Rangel. Thanks to Sarah LaDuke and David Gustina for leading the charge in Lockbox Central. Whatever you can do to help fill the lockbox before Monday. Every dollar we make now, we don't have to make afterward. That would be so great. Oh, my God, that would be so really wonderful if it was done before we started. Just mentioning that. 800-323-9262,
WAMC.org. Such a great point, right? In the spring, the Democrats voted for a continuing resolution, and then Congress defunded public radio. So yeah. I feel like we're making the point.
Yes.
That being agreeable does not get the results that that party is seeking.
Yeah. Yes.
But that's a really, I think it's a really important point. And I've got three things I just want to toss on the table. One is that there's timing right now that allows a different level of political theater, because you're still far enough away from the midterms that you can play stupid reindeer games. But once you're beyond the midterms, you are, you know, the day after the midterm elections next November, we're going to be into the presidentials. It's going to be a mess. The other thing that I would contend is that a lot of these policies are increasingly and clearly unpopular. So let's just pick on soybeans for a second. There's a moment right now that's occurring in the agricultural community, that they realize that China has bought $0 of soybeans. Okay, the economy is crashing, and it's crashing in red states. It's going to get worse. So there's the notion that Voight and Project 2025, and Bo, I do think there is a plan. It's called Project 2025. Yeah. And I don't know what the equivalent is on the Democratic side. And you're right. And I think that adds to it. But the idea is that they know that a lot of what they're doing, the people will hate. So they're going to do it. And they're going to break the system so that when people wake up and realize that this was really bad for the country, they're not going to be able to repair the damage. That it will take multiple generations to bring back even the federal workforce. And the federal workforce is different than other workforces. In having worked in both local, state, and federal government, I can tell you that the difference at the local level is that you have to do a lot of things. At the federal government, you need to be a mile deep and an inch wide. These are true experts in a lot of the areas, and getting that expertise back is not easy, and it's not going to be cheap. And then I think there's a really interesting issue about federalism that we should be talking about, and that's the fact that, and I don't remember if it was Bo or Roger, one of you said, you know, states aren't allowed to run a deficit. So the idea of who funds what becomes hugely, hugely important. They also can't go back midterm, you know, sort of mid-year and change their budgets, because now the federal government's pulled the rug out from underneath them. But I also note this, Joe, is that think about where state and locals get their money. They get it from sales tax. Guess what's happening? People aren't spending because the tariffs are screwing everything up. Okay, things are a lot more expensive. People are self-regulating on spending. Another huge area of funding is property tax. And if you're not looking, if you haven't been watching, there are bubbles that are already starting to burst. So if you look at, like, let's talk about the real estate down in Miami. It's a mess. Okay, Florida isn't just going to be underwater from the hurricanes. It's going to be financially underwater. And in the past, we would have said the federal government is going to be in a position to potentially support the states. They're not doing that. They're not going to be in a position to do that, which is going to, I think, is going to continue to lead to a degradation in our economy and also in the public's collective sense of the strength of the economy and the willingness to buy, which means that people aren't going to be buying cars. They're not going to be, I'm sorry, vehicles. They're not going to be traveling. There aren't going to be goods on the shelves. I think we're in a really bad spiral right now, and this is going to exacerbate that.
We have letters. Let me get to those. Margaret says, I'm a little perplexed at the media's slamming of the Democrats. In the last shutdown, the Democrats agreed to pass the continuing resolution and negotiate later. The Republicans reneged. There was no negotiation. They doubled down. There's an old saying, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. That's what's going on here, and I don't understand why that's not the headline today, because they're not making it the headline. Yeah. They should be making it the headline, and they're not making it the headline. Right. I don't disagree with Margaret's point, but I do think that they have the opportunity to make that point, and they're not doing it.
And let's tip our hat to the Republicans.
Right now, over your head, is a press conference that's taking place on Capitol Hill with a lot of white men. And they are all talking about how bad the Democrats are and of closing down our government. Where are the Democrats?
And they're telling a lie that's not true about that health care being extended to illegal immigrants. I don't remember what I was going to say, Joe.
Oh, I'm sorry. I hate when I do that.
No.
I apologize.
No, it's my and today is actually Older People's Day too, so I'm celebrating that by showing you how old I am.
You'll think of it later. You know what? We always need content. So if you know, like 2 o'clock this afternoon, you think of it, just call Vox Pop.
Oh no, it's 2 o'clock in the morning when I remember it. That's my problem.
Fran writes, "Why is no one mentioning that Trump appears to be insane?"
I remember it.
Okay. Oh well, I
remember
it.
Sorry, Fran.
Sorry, Fran. Hold on to that thought, Fran.
Don't worry, Trump will still be insane in 5 minutes. Go ahead.
But the success of using the court cases and the misuse of executive and political power has, I think, cowed the corporate media to the point where you can't trust anything that's coming out of them. It's all because of the lawsuits and the payout and the retribution that has been allowed. And I'll go back to what I've said before. As much as I dislike Donald Trump and what he's doing in the executive branch, I blame blame the legislative branch more, because they have given him emergency powers that he should never have had. So that's why you can't trust what's coming out a lot of the media right now.
And I think I think you're right, Bob. I think you're absolutely right. Riffing on something that Joe has brought up a couple of times is this lack of a coherent and persuasive and I think charismatic message from the leadership in the Democratic Party. That too is contributing to this particular moment in a way that I think might be unprecedented. I always ask my students, who's the leader of the Democratic Party? And technically, the highest ranking official in the Democratic Party is Chuck Schumer, right? So Hakeem Jeffries is close there. But who's the leader of the Democratic Party? It's probably Barack Obama. And Barack Obama still is under the radar. If the Democrats have Barack Obama as the leader, I'm a huge Barack Obama fan, but if he's the leader, the Democrats' message is getting subdued and softened.
Joe, can I answer the Democrat question?
Absolutely.
That was answered before? Because I'm sympathetic in one sense to the person who wrote in, although in that I think the Democrats are trying to fight right now, and they did, you know, try and quote unquote do the right thing back in March when they went along with the continuing resolution, and they were ignored. And I think that's true. when some of us talk about, or when I talk about the feckless Democrats and the tragedy of the Democrats, it's that, look, we know what Trump, and here's where I disagree, I think, with Bo a little bit. You know, I think we know what Trump wants. I don't think Trump wants a white nationalist country. There are people in the Trump movement and people in the administration, Stephen Miller being one of them, who should do some atoning today, who do I think, want a white nationalist country. But Trump doesn't get elected last time, and he won't get elected in the future without large numbers of Hispanics, black voters, women, and others. And I don't think we are a country that is in danger of turning into a white nationalist country. And I think that's not helpful to move around. He wants to break the system. The problem I think that the Democrats have is they still, it's shocking, but they still are committed to the system. They still, in a way, identify with the system, even though they're losing control of it. And I'm not sure they're willing to go to the mat with Trump. He's willing to break the system. He's willing to, you know, Nick said, you know, that there's laws, they can't fire everyone. Well, you know, he's shown that he's willing to break those laws. Whether some of them will be reinstated 6 months later by the courts or not, who knows? But I don't know if the Democrats believe enough in what in fighting in this political fight that they're willing to break the system, and that's what I think is what's going on.
Polly says,
"What about Fran?"
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
poor Fran.
Sorry, Fran.
Well, Fran was talking about the insanity of the president. Why no one is talking about the fact this after the meeting, which I'm going to get to in a second. Polly simply just says we're screwed. So I thought I'd add that.
Poignant.
Just like straight into the point, right? Okay, so let's talk because we have a few minutes to set this up, and then when we come back after the lockbox break, we'll talk about it. The meeting yesterday regarding military leaders, and I don't know how much you all got to see of this. It was unlike anything I've ever seen, and so we will. Here's basically in a nutshell. In the end, it was just another campaign-style presentation. President Trump and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth recited a familiar litany of partisan culture war talking points in their highly anticipated call-up of several hundred military officers on Tuesday. This from the New York Times. In a rambling and sometimes incoherent speech in which he praised his own tariffs, insulted former President Joe Biden, Mr. Trump disclosed that he had told Mr. Hegseth to use American cities as training grounds for the military. It was an evolution of one of Mr. Trump's favorite themes, that cities run by Democrats are lawless urban hellscapes. But now he was telling military commanders charged with waging war his thinking on where their next deployment could be. It seems that the ones that are run by the radical left Democrats, what they've done to San Francisco, to Chicago, to New York, to Los Angeles, they're very unsafe places, the president told the generals and admirals at a military base in Virginia. And we're going to straighten them out one by one, and this is going to be a major part for some of the people in this room. That's a war too, Mr. Trump said. It's a war from within. The comments were greeted by expressionless faces. The Pentagon senior military leaders had warned the officers not to react or cheer per the norms of what is supposed to be a nonpartisan military. The result, the audience was quiet and much more still than Mr. Trump usually encounters in his stump speeches. One senior officer said they were told to clap only when the Joint Chiefs of Staff did, like at the State of the Union address. Bob.
So, several issues here, and there are a couple of silver linings. Unprecedented, I would also argue that it was unnecessary to put the national security at such a risk, and we're not talking enough about the fact that we could have been in a very difficult situation should somebody have decided to take a whack at all of our senior military commanders. I did appreciate the stillness. I know it was not appreciated by the president, who was pitching for applause as if it was some comedian game show. I also appreciate the fact that the troops didn't see their commanders getting behind some of the outrageous statements that were being made by both Hezgeth and Trump. I don't think this is being reported enough. The incoherence of Donald Trump and the slurring of his words is something that we cannot continue to ignore. And if you looked at that, and if you looked at what happened in the Oval Office yesterday, there is a clear cognitive decline that is going on with Donald Trump. And that's I want to put a marker in that, because I think this is a problem this country is going to have to face before the end of his current administration. The language, this idea of the training ground and the war within, I will just poke at the hypocrisy of Fox and some of the right wing media about. I think it is unacceptable. I think I would tell you right now that if it was a Democrat, a Democratic administration who made that, I would tell you that it was unacceptable. But the idea of even the threat of use of military force against Americans, to me, is one of the most egregious issues facing the country. And that's on top of all the other issues that we were talking about. My only hope is that the military command will remember their oath is not to the president, but it's to the Constitution. Because we're setting some seeds that really, really worry me, and I think lead to potential abuses that we really should be talking about.
All right, let's just have about half a minute, and we're going to go over. So I'm going to hold here, and then we'll go over to Lockbox Central, and then we'll come back and hear from the rest of you on this particular subject. We also welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will continue our conversation on the roundtable panel this morning, right after this short break.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Bo Breslin, Roger Berkowitz, Bob Griffin, and Nick Rangel making up the group. We've got about 15 minutes or so left, and we are talking about the meeting that took place yesterday as the president and the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, recounted familiar partisan complaints to top military leaders. And so we welcome your letters on that, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Bo.
Yeah, so I'll say a couple of quick things that I think the media is not paying as much attention to, although they're paying some attention to it. So I want to focus on two things in particular, two messages that Pete Hegseth in particular brought out to the generals. One is the woke mentality of, you know, we're going to eliminate the woke mentality in the Defense Department. I refuse to call it the Department of War. I'll call it the Defense Department. One of the interesting things is that he's speaking in a vacuum, in large part. There has been a long conversation about diversity in the military that dates back for quite a while, and I'll bring up just two moments of that long conversation. In the early 2000s, when the Supreme Court was considering the idea of affirmative action in colleges and law schools coming out of the University of Michigan, there was an amicus friend of the court brief that had been signed by Norman Schwarzkopf and 35 other of the most important generals saying, saying, and I'll quote, this one's from the 2023 one, but the quote from this amicus brief, this friend of the court brief to the Supreme Court, diversity in the halls of academia directly affects performance in the theaters of war. And the 50-page document goes on to talk about the value of having a diverse military, especially at the top, for not only the quality of the work that goes on the battlefield, but the morale of the soldiers and so on. So there's a whole bunch of Republican voices out there that are opposed, and some of the great historical thinkers, Colin Powell and so on, who are opposed to exactly what Pete Hegseth is saying about this sort of very shallow, superficial notion of what diversity is. Secondly, the piece, this is my last point, the piece through strength argument that Pete Hegseth talks about, I'm troubled by the piece through strength argument. Of course, Trump admires those that display peace through strength, or at least pretend they do. Putin, Xi, Kim Jong-un, Netanyahu, peace through strength mentality. And Trump sees European leaders as weak, those who lean towards diplomacy as opposed to bombs and bullets. He sees those leaders as weak. He forgets, though, that he ignores the lessons of Vietnam when we tried to change regime democracy through strength, and that didn't work out too well. He forgets the lessons of Afghanistan and Iraq when we're doing the same sort of things. Sure, he's the legacy of the Cold War. America was able to win the Cold War, but primarily because of our economic dominance, not necessarily only because of our superior military force. So this peace through strength argument, I'm opposed to as a good, solid Democrat. I actually think diplomacy is always the first order of business. This administration seems to think otherwise.
Yes. And peace through strength is a misnomer. It's really peace through violence, and we should call violence what it is. On the DEI and recruitment piece, I'll just start by saying my mom was in the Army and my dad is Mexican and was in the Marine Corps, and both of my step parents, my stepmother and my stepdad, were in the military, and so my mom was part of the service as a in this administration's viewpoint as a DEI hire and recruit, and so was my dad. And I just think of the way that this administration talks about our service members and how deeply offensive it is to the tens of thousands of people who are now being identified as DEI recruits or being allowed to serve this country, which they do with honor and with respect for the Constitution, as just so demoralizing. At a moment when recruitment for the military is down by more than 25% and missing its mark on over 15,000 recruits a year, I agree with Bo that we know statistically that diversity brings a wealth of knowledge and experience, cultural humility and competency. But we also know that we need to, if we are in agreement that we need more service members, we need to expand that recruitment pool into deeper and more diverse populations in order to meet those goals. Now, I don't know, maybe we're not in agreement about needing to have more soldiers. That's a different conversation. But if the agreement is we need to fill those ranks, you have to do that with more diverse applicant pools. And that only happens if you're not out there calling people fat beardos, because that is just a gross way to talk about our service members.
Roger.
Yeah, I mean, it was very difficult to watch this thing. I didn't watch the whole thing. I watched parts of it, and it was disturbing. You know, I think the first thing I want to say is it's worthwhile having a conversation about DEI in general at universities, where I think it's had positive impacts in certain ways and negative impacts. And I don't think it's terrible for the Secretary of Defense to want to have a conversation about it. That said, I agree with Nick 100%, right? It's offensive the way they're going about it. There's a certain irony to call people unqualified when Pete Hegseth is about as unqualified as you can imagine to be the Secretary of Defense. You know, competence and humility, the two sort of core values of the Marine Corps, there's certainly no competence and there's certainly no humility. This was a flex, if I can use that word here. I mean, again, I've said before, I think we have to understand what's going on. The president and his inner circle want the kind of power that we call tyrannical power. They want to have the military bow to them. They want to have the universities bow to them. They want everyone to kiss their ring, their hands, whatever it is. He wants power. He wants to be able to push a button or tell someone to push a button and blow up a Venezuelan speedboat against the rules. He wants the military to sit there and have to listen to him. Hegseth could have gone out and talked to people and had real conversations about DEI or about training or fitness. By bringing them in, as Bob said, into this very dangerous situation and making them sit there, it's just about power. And we have to understand that that's what's going on, which is why this shutdown is actually meaningful. Because if one side is going to play by power, right, the question is, what does the other side do? Do they bring a knife to the gunfight or do they play by the same rules? I still don't know what the Democrats are going to do. I'm not sure what they should do. But if you're going to fight Trump, if you think he's dangerous, it may be that the only way to fight him is through competing on the realm of power. And that's going to get dirty and difficult.
And Joe, I think Roger makes some really interesting points that I would also toss this out, is that I do worry that as a country that we've forgotten about the value of human life. So some of the language that I've saw, and I saw a really interesting article about how where Hegseth wants to go is back to the 1990s, where we know that the military had some real moral issues. Mm. And I also worry that we have a president who obviously did not serve in the military. None of his children have served in the military. So the idea of the military becomes sort of this abstract concept that that other people will do it, and it's glorious, and it's almost back. We're almost back to the sort of the British model of elites in the officer corps, and the scrubs of society will go in and wage war, and while it's glorious, they don't think about the death and disaster that goes along with this, and. The leadership of this country should, in my mind, only be using the military as the very last resort, not the first, which I think gets back to what you said, Bo, and I think that's really an important point. But as a society, are we prepared for our children who are in the military to sacrifice because of the narcissistic leadership of this administration? And that's another one of those sort of third rail issues that I fear that given Hegseth and given Trump that they are too willing to use the military because the cost isn't theirs to bear.
So, where do you think this goes? I mean, obviously, members of the military who are in that group aren't going to speak out. So you
are or aren't?
Aren't.
They should.
They should.
And they should resign.
And I do think they look, I mean, there were a number of people who were quoted on the condition of anonymity and so forth over the last 24 hours. But
can I say something to that?
Yes, absolutely.
There's an old debate that goes back, you know. I mean, it goes back all the time, but was widely talked about in the 1930s and 40s, both in Germany and in Soviet Union, of whether you should stay in the government and try and, you know, soften things or whether you should resign, right? We had it with Nixon. We've had a lot of these issues. And it's often phrased in the terms of the lesser evil. The problem with the lesser evil is that if you're really talking about evil, it's still evil.
Yeah.
And at some point, it's better to resign, walk away. It's not clean your hands and serve as an act of resistance than to continue to play in that game. And I think there's a lot of people in the military who still think we can save this military institution. And look, I did not serve in the military, but I am constantly telling my students, you should. I think you know, it's an act of patriotism. I think one of the things that would help this country immeasurably is mandatory public service, whether it's military or something else. But I think that there's a great tradition of people who serve in the military who believe in public service, who believe that it's the foundation of a diverse and orderly and legal republic. And I think it's being taken apart. And I'm not sure whether people should stay in it and try and save it from within or leave. But I think that pretty soon they're going to have to make that decision. And they probably are going to have to resign if they want to keep their soul.
There's a third option. Mm-hmm. Wait until you're removed, right? If you decide to stay in a position and you then do push back on that administrative directive and you do so steadfast and honorably and within the confines of the law, you wait until you're removed. And I think that sends a stronger message than acquiescing at leaving before.
I agree. I'm with you on that.
Everything hits the fan. Yeah. So to me,
I meant
speak out and get removed.
You know, be willing to speak out and get removed.
But I do see that there are a number of generals, a number of leadership individuals who are speaking out, who are standing their ground and who are saying, come say it to my face.
Yeah. I love the idea of Roger, what you're talking about. And Nick,
yeah,
I like
30 seconds.
Yeah, I like the third option. In the cacophony of social media and the fact that the media itself is being blurred by so many voices, I'm not sure anybody who walks away can get a platform or a bullhorn enough to make a difference. And I think that probably makes people reluctant.
Nick Rangel gets the last word on a plug.
Yes. Please don't forget to visit our website, lasny.org, to learn all about our upcoming award ceremony, October 22nd. We are featuring keynote speaker Nilanjana Dasgupta. She's the author of Change the Wallpaper as our keynote.
I appreciate you all. Thank you so much for being with us. It's a great pleasure. We'll be right back after this.